RadioInfluence.com.
We are back for another edition of the MMA Report Podcast with Daniel Galvan. I am Jason Floyd. It is November the 4th, Daniel, which you know what that means, Daniel. I guess I do not have to worry about my mailbox being filled and getting spam text messages.
Yeah, I feel like in such a divisive time, Jason, that's a really nice way for us to all unify. I swear, if I get another damn call, another damn text for the next, 2 years, because I'm sure midterm elections will get more stuff. If I get that, I'm going to riot. So I know, regardless of whatever place our listeners may side on, I think we can all agree it's going to be nice not to get those annoying damn messages. So, yes, I'm glad you have found the silver lining in this very stressful, anxiety-ridden, no fun at all time, Jason.
Yeah, sometimes I'm just looking for a certain piece of mail to come in, and I've got to go through about, 12 advertisements. I'm like, man, I cannot wait for November 4th to get here. But, of course, this is a mixed martial arts podcast where we're not here to talk about politics, but, there definitely is a political angle to talk about this week in terms of mixed martial arts. We'll get into that with the Guardian article with a Andrew Yang interview and talking about the expansion of the Muhammad Ali Act to mixed martial arts. Also, we're going to talk about the future of Anderson Silva, of course, lost last weekend to Uriah Hall. And we'll see whether or not he has any more fights left in him, as it does kind of seem pretty clear that he maybe doesn't want to hang it up there. Also, we'll talk about the comments that Bryce Mitchell made following his fight in Las Vegas, of course, getting a big win there against Andre Filia, talking about his anti-mask comments. Also, we're going to take a look ahead to this week's MMA. Plenty of MMA to take in this week if you do want to take in some mixed martial arts. But Daniel, even before this article on The Guardian came out, it was written by Loretta Hunt as, an interview that she did with Andrew Yang, which I think in MMA circles knows, how much he's a supporter of mixed martial arts fighters. I know there was an article, and I'm sure you probably more about this than I do, of, him wanting to help out WWE performers and, I guess, trying to make them employees as opposed to independent contractors. And it was something that, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, I was kind of thinking about, things to talk about. And one of the things of, obviously, with the election being, so much a big top talking point here in the United States, and the fact of, as we do this show here on Wednesday morning at 8:30 a.m. Eastern time, 7:30 there in the Central Time Zone where Daniel's at, we don't know who is the president. We're still kind of waiting to see. But one of the things that I kind of wanted to mention, because I don't know how many MMA podcasts are really talking about this, that, if Joe Biden does win and becomes our next president, it's going to make things very interesting on the UFC because, as I talked about a couple of months ago here on this podcast, that the bill to expand the Muhammad Ali Boxing Act to mixed martial arts has not made it out of committee. And I have had people tell me that as long as the president of the United States is Donald Trump, that bill is never going to make it out of committee, which would obviously tell you why the UFC is kind of in a very good position. And look, no matter whether it's a UFC belt or any other mixed martial arts organization, the likelihood is that they do not want the Ali Act expand to MMA. But Daniel, to me, and it's a good article. You can check it out there on Twitter. It's all over the place. Various MMA websites have been talking about it. But I thought the quote at the end of the article really kind of sums up my thoughts on it. And this was Andrew Yang saying, quote, "Applying the Ali Act would be a big step forward. But to me, MMA fighters need either a union or pro association so they can negotiate a fair share of the revenue stream. Big changes need to happen. And I'd like to do this on a human level." I thought that was a very great way to sum up this article. And because one of the things that has always been said to me is that the Ali Act is not magically going to give UFC, may not automatically give UFC fighters a bigger share of the revenue, but it would be a step in the right. It would be the good step to kind of help fighters out.
Yeah, for fighters, it's a positive. It's not the end all be all. And I think it's clear, right, the UFC wants the Trump presidency to continue, and it logically makes sense for the UFC to want that, because the logic is there will be probably a bigger portion of money in their bank account. And that is a great reason for an organization to want someone to remain in office, because it's clear that the Ali Act will, you know, stay in the cupboard. And it's just, I'm looking at it from a pure money standpoint. I think it's kind of funny that the presidential election really is important in the MMA world, more so than ever before. Because on one side, we have an administration who won't take up the Ali Act. And on the other side, we have a guy who maybe might be the Secretary of Labor, who grew up as a fan of combat sports and still is. And that is going to be something that is on his mind. You know, he will have some type of influence on the Democratic administration if the Democrats win. So it's really intriguing, the idea that mixed martial arts is actually tied to the presidential election. It's not like Al Gore and George Bush were talking about it, right? Like the last time politics played a major role is more so not with elections, but just people in office deciding to allow or not allow the sport to take place in their state. So it's quite intriguing. And I'm someone who's probably more open to the ideas that Andrew Yang is floating around. And what I really like about what he's saying is the very end that you touched on. It's a very, very nuanced idea that maybe some politicians who wanted to put the Ali Act forward would do it and then take their ball, go home and play another game with another sport or business. Whereas with Andrew, it seems like he has a much bigger picture looking at it. And as someone who thinks the fighters deserve a bigger chunk of the pie, I personally like that idea. And I just think for the fighters to get a bigger chunk of the pie in an organization like the UFC, they're going to need an outside factor to create that possibility, whether it be a union or governmental oversight. The reason being is there's no motivation for the guys on top like Dana and the office to give more of the cheddar to those guys. There's no leverage that the fighters are displaying. And if you're a business, you're making a lot of money, you're going to give as little as possible to your employees unless your hand is forced.
You're spot on about that. No question about it. You know, I think that one of the things I will mention is that when I have talked to people in the industry about it, and I've talked to managers about it, you know, one of the more questions I would say that comes up is how does it make things better for fighters? I think it's a very unknown thing. We're not here to talk about politics. We're just trying to talk about, you know, if one thing happens or the other thing happens, how it could have an effect on our sport. Now, look, and obviously in the article indicates about how Andrew Yang will most likely, if, you know, Joe Biden is elected president, will be a part of his cabinet. And obviously that is not news that the UFC wants to hear. Now, this article was very UFC centric, but I also say that if somehow the Ali Act came into MMA, it would have an effect on every MMA promoter. It would have an effect on Bellator, even though I think Bellator pays substantially higher number in terms of their revenue to fighters than the UFC does. We've all seen kind of the numbers that are being circulated with the antitrust lawsuit. I have no idea, you know, the exact percentages that Bellator is paying its fighters, but I would imagine it's very similar to what Strikeforce was paying their fighters. And of course, we've seen those numbers come out in the antitrust lawsuit. So, but I also, I, you know, over the years, one of the things that's always been said to me is that, yes, if the Ali Act comes to MMA, yes, it will obviously have an effect on certain things, particularly with the UFC, but it could also have an effect on the regional scene. And we're in a very weird time in mixed martial arts. You know, I look at fighters who are regional level fighters. Maybe they're still a couple steps away from, you know, getting a potentially a contender series type fight. You know, maybe they're a really solid ticket seller that, you know, they fought on Bellator undercards and they've been able to make some nice coin because of being able to be a ticket seller. But now, obviously, you know, Bellator isn't using ticket sellers because, well, there's no tickets to be sold. So, like, I look at it and say, like, right now it's a very tough time. You know, I had a friend say to me, he was talking about a regional level fighter who was basically kind of complaining about the money that was being offered. And I'm like, man, you have to understand that, you know, the revenues that are coming in for promoters are so much less right now. And I commend any regional level promoter that has the ability to do show, because I can only imagine what that bottom line looks like right now as opposed to a year ago.
Yeah, the revenue is going to be so minimal. I mean, for the regional scene, you know, regional mixed martial arts or regional professional wrestling compared to mainstream wrestling are two different businesses, right? Mainstream wrestling / mainstream mixed martial arts are first and foremost in 2020, they're a streaming business. It's all about digital. It's all about video. It's all about television. That's where a lot of the money is made. For the most part, it's made on the TV rights deals, and then it's made on the pay-per-view. That's where the income is coming from. Whereas the regional, it's not even the same business. It's a live attendance business, right? Like, not enough people are watching streaming versions of regional shows to make any money off of it. So it's funny, even though it's the same sport, it's two different types of businesses. And this type of business, the regional scene, has been non-existent for a while now. And now things are starting to open up and you're starting to get people in crowds, but I think it's going to be hard to find a state where there isn't some type of restriction. And for a regional show, I think that's a real handicap. And even if there isn't any restrictions in the state where you're trying to run a show, I think people are going to be less apt to go to an event than before. And it's going to take a very long time, right? Like, even a year down the line, who knows, right? Until we're living in a world where we feel comfortable going outside and not getting COVID-19, I think there's going to be everlasting effects on regional show attendance. And that's where the money is made in so many different ways, even past the ticketing, including concessions and stuff like that. So it's a hard, hard deal and a hard pill to swallow. If you're a regional fighter, I think the Ali Act would be good for them. I think it'd be harder for promoters on the regional scene. That would make their life a lot more difficult. I think the PFL would be in trouble in terms of that. I mean, they would have to make a bigger adjustment, I think, than Bellator, especially when you think back to the older days of the PFL when it seemed like everybody was represented by Ray Sefo. But now, you know, it's a different time. But still, I think they would make a bigger adjustment than Bellator. I think Bellator is more apt to work within the framework of the Ali Act. So for a regional fighter, I mean, there's no other way to say it other than we're living in a reality that sucks for them. It sucks for their promoter. And the money, if the regional MMA promoter's goal is to break even, it's a massive pay cut for the fighters they're putting on their fight cards.
Look, if your goal right now is to break even as MMA promoter, I mean, I guess my question would be is, why put on a show if you're not going to be able to make money? That's just me. But I understand that maybe.
What regional MMA guy is making money? What MMA promoter is able to buy a house because they're putting on shows regional? I don't think that person exists.
In terms of a full-time job, I'm with you on that. But I think what it comes down to is that if you live in a region where you have the right ticket sellers and the right people that know how to put, you know, butts in the seats, you can make, you know, decent money as a regional promoter.
You could be right. I just feel like people who promote regional mixed martial arts and pro wrestling shows, their biggest motivation is just they just love it and they're hoping to break even and make a little bit of money. But I just feel like when the motivation is money, it's like, when the motivation is money, you're in the wrong business. Go get a welding license and you'll make some money, because you are not going to make a livable income off of regional MMA. But you are right. I think for a regional MMA promoter, if you're trying to make money, it's more so the business model of how you're going about getting people's butts in seats, selling tickets, sponsorships, etc. Because like, even if you luck into guys who are good ticket sellers, if they're good ticket sellers, they're gonna be out of your territory sooner than you would like. They're gonna go somewhere else if they're able to make that money, Jason.
No, you're right. I mean, look, I feel for regional level promoters right now, because I think you mentioned a great point. You know, there's going to be someone who may have purchased tickets in the past that's just like, you know what? I just don't want to put myself in that environment. I will tell you, I went to Universal Studios in Orlando on Sunday. I took my nieces over there, and I was blown away with just kind of how they did things. And I thought they're, you know, in terms of making everyone, you know, feel safe, you know, before kind of you do anything, they've got someone sitting there with hand sanitizer to put on your hands before you go on any rides. And I was kind of blown away with it. And I think that's just, it's a world we live in. And, you know, so we'll see what happens with the Ali Act, but just something that we did want to mention here at the beginning of the show. Of course, last weekend we saw, what was, marketed as the final fight for Anderson Silva. After that fight is over, you hear Anderson Silva talk, you necessarily don't walk away with it thinking that this is a guy who wants to hang up his gloves. Dana White, after the fact, saying, you know what, he just feels bad for booking that fight. And, you know, look, for a good amount of that fight, it wasn't, you know, I felt like I was watching a little bit of a staring type contest between Anderson Silva and Uriah Hall. But of course, Uriah Hall goes out there and gets the win in the fourth round, getting the TKO victory. And I just, after, you know, I thought there was moments where Anderson looked good, but you know, once kind of he got off balance, whatnot, and took some chances, he gets caught, and the fight comes to an end. And I'm just at this point, Daniel, where I don't have an appetite to want to see Anderson Silva compete in mixed martial arts again.
Yeah, I don't either. I don't either. I mean, he looked fine in rounds one and two. He just never looked dangerous. He never looked like he was going to put Uriah in trouble. And I think when you're at a point as a fighter, we're just going out there and not getting demolished, looking competitive is a success. Whenever you're just out there running your paces and throwing some leg kicks, just doing okay without minimal contact, whenever that's considered a positive, it's time to retire, right? It's like we're treating it like he like my old, you know, my old uncle who's having a hard time, you know, doing the Sudoku puzzle, you know, in his old age, and all of a sudden he does like a, you know, a good job remembering his name, and we're like, yeah, like that's where we're at with one of the greatest fighters of all time, right? Like he does okay things in the cage, and we're like, the spider is back. Let's do 5 more fights. He's got 7 more fights on his deal. Let's get him in the UFC till he's 52 years old. It's like, no, he probably shouldn't fight anymore. But the only thing is, like, he's okay. He's talented because, you know, he was a GOAT, right? He's literally, there was a point in time when it was either him or GSP for who was the greatest fighter of all time. And he's still part of the top 10, obviously. What a legendary run at 185. But it's time for him to hang it up. The only downside is, for such a legend and a guy who still is competitive and still can't compete with most UFC middleweights, you would like to get a storybook ending. And you want to see it happen, but that so rarely happens in mixed martial arts. And I just think for Anderson, he's going to have to, at this point, be told by Dana White, I'm not giving you another fight, because it just seems like as soon as his quote-unquote last fight is over, man, he has that burning desire for another one. But at some point, it's like, we can't be getting a 50-year-old Anderson Silva in the UFC octagon. It's time to pull him out of there. That is a dangerous amount of damage past your prime.
Yeah, it's just you watch the fight, and I mean, like, if the reality is this is a 45-year-old fighter, and you can't help to think about, when you think about the legacy of Anderson Silva, if Anderson Silva retires after he beats Stephen Bonner, you know, our thought of his legacy, I think, is much different. You know, I think when we talked about the greatest of all time last week here on the podcast, and Anderson Silva is a guy that just doesn't get mentioned anymore. And it's primarily because of what has happened, you know, since losing the middleweight title against Chris Weidman. He's only won one time, you know, since then. And so, you know, and I agree with, you know, there's things that I can, you know, kind of have a WTF moment with Dana White, particularly him talking about how Robert Whittaker doesn't want to fight Israel Adesanya. I'm like, whoa, that is not what he said. You are taking what he said totally out of context, you know, and I know Robert Whitaker's now on the interview going, yeah, I didn't say that. I said, I don't want to fight until after my wife has our next child. And, you know, and he's not a rush to get in there, which basically it's like, Dana White, just say, man, it doesn't fit your timetable. But I do agree with what Dana White, you know, he said about Anderson Silva, where he's just like, you know, look, this is where the family's got to come in and they got to tell him, Anderson, it's time to retire, man. It's just, you know, it's just that you hope that there are people in the Anderson Silva inner circle that can sit there and say, Anderson, it's time. The time has come. You know, if he wants to do jiu-jitsu competitions and things along those lines, yes. But in terms of an MMA fight or a boxing matchup, I have zero appetite to see it. And I just hope there's people in that inner circle that'll tell him that. And look, if the UFC say, you know what, Anderson, you want to continue fighting, we're going to release you out of your deal, wish you well in your future endeavors, I don't think Bellator would be interested. I just don't. I think Scott Coker would not be interested in that matchup. I think it would become very difficult. I mean, maybe Anderson goes over to one championship, but I know a lot of people, I think, magically when a high price or notable fighter comes on the market, that magically Bellator is just going to, you know, throw an empty checkbook at him. I don't see Bellator wanting to be in the Anderson Silva business.
God, that's a tough one. I think they would, dude. I think they would. I think if today Anderson was no longer with the UFC, I think Bellator would pick him up, though. I really do, because I think it's too irresistible if you're Bellator, because Anderson, even though he's super past his prime, and God, I hadn't really thought about the fact that he hadn't won more than one fight since the Bonner fight. But that's insane, right? Like, for a GOAT, a guy who was the GOAT, to have only won one fight since 2012, that's an absurd statistic. Although most of his fights have been against world championship level guys. It's been tough competition. He hasn't fought all the time. But, I think the two things that affect his legacy was, number one, first and foremost, as you stated, the run of losses, and then also I think the steroids, drostanolone and androsterone, stuff like that. I think that really affected his legacy too, in terms of being the clear cut GOAT. But I just think it's going to be a little too appetizing for Bellator, because Anderson Silva's name value is really still pretty big, and he's a difference maker more so than any other person that's on that free agent market. Like, he's a guy Bellator could use for two or three big time fights for that promotion to get more eyeballs and promote. That's the thing why I think Bellator would reach out to him, Jason.
I don't see it. I think that if you know, just in looking what Bellator has done over, the past couple of months, where, you know, look, I just think that there's a different approach in terms of free agency, and I like what they're doing. I mean, look, there's going to be some cards that, you know, tomorrow's card is not the most appealing on paper. I mean, who knows? Maybe the fight card ends up delivering, but I just don't believe that they will go, you know, they will go down the Anderson road. Speaking of Anderson,
why do you say that?
I think it's A, you ready to shell out 200, 300, 400 grand for a 45-year-old fighter who, let's be honest about it, if I gave you the top 15 UFC middleweights, who's he beat?
Hey, I got a question for you. If he fights Melvin Manhoef, 44-year-old Bellator main eventer, this weekend, who wins? I would pick Anderson over Manhoef.
I would. I would pick Anderson. But, I mean, the fact is, it's what has Anderson become? And, you know, and Dana White even mentioned, he said, he goes, you got to really look at it if a commission would approve that fight. I just don't believe.
A commission would, Dana, because the commissions are dumb as hell sometimes. Sometimes those damn commissions, they make some questionable fights. There's some brilliant commissions, but by God, we've seen some questionable fights. Like,
dude, the scoring on Henry Krauss, Brandon Gertz, how one judge saw that 30-27 for Brandon Gertz is, I mean, you talk about a WTF moment. That is a prime example of, I wish, like, after the fight was over, we could just go, Judge, please explain to me how you did not score any of that fight for Henry Corrales when he clearly won the fight.
He fell asleep. That guy fell asleep. And he woke up right when the clapper sounded, and he was like, crap. Oh, God. I don't know what I'm going to do on my scorecard. You're right. That one was absolute trash. Like, as soon as he turned in that scorecard, they should have grabbed it and put it in the trash and just announced, we only have two judges' decisions we're going to read today.
I mean, look, that's just one of those things of, like, I would have loved to been a fly on the wall when Mike Mazzulli questioned him on that scorecard.
Yeah, I would too, man. I would too. It's a tough point for Mazzulli to be in, but I think he does it better than most in terms of holding people accountable. But I think when you're in those jobs, it's a very tough role to play as in that role, but also as a guy who analyzes job performance of people like that. And I would love to be a fly on the wall. I'm sure it was plenty respectful, but if I was in his position, I would just throw fits and not communicate well at all. I would be like, what the hell is wrong with you? What were you seeing, you dumb? Do you know how it works? How people win fights? Like what is going on, you idiot? Like, that's what I would say, whereas I would assume people like in Mazzulli's position are a lot more respectful, and richer.
And somewhat kind of interesting, the fact that Henry Corrales is now going to go down 135 pounds.
Yeah, man. He looked good against Brandon Gertz. And at 135 pounds, I mean, it's not a deep division. He's going to find himself in a position to challenge for a title. And his stand-up looks sharp. And what he did the best in that fight was he controlled the pace of the fight in terms of the output. Like in terms of striking, that was Henry's fight. And I think that's a great move for him if he's able to make it healthy, right? Like if he goes down to 135 and it zaps a lot out of him, that's a double-edged sword. But if he's able to make that weight class, he's the roadmap to a bantamweight championship around his waist is just a lot easier than at 145.
I'll tell you this, you got to give Bellator credit. They've really boosted up that 135-pound division. I mean, it's now becoming a division where, I mean, it seemed like they had like five guys in it. And now, all of a sudden, they've added some great fighters, to that division. We'll talk a little bit about Bellator here in a little bit. But, you know, I was looking at the UFC middleweight rankings. And, of course, you know, Uriah Hall is kind of the guy we're really not talking about. But, you know, right now, as I look at it here, currently the number 9 challenger in the middleweight division. And, like, I look at Uriah Hall, and I just wonder what is the ceiling for this guy. I mean, look, there's been these moments in the octagon where he has produced these tremendous knockouts, but then there's other times where he doesn't perform well. I mean, you forget this is a guy that, you know, several years ago defeated Gegard Mousasi. So, I mean, he's shown the ability to defeat top guys. But if I said, would you pick him against the top 5 of this division? And not counting the champion Israel Adesanya, Whitaker, Costa, Cannonier, Hermanson, Romero.
Oh, man. There's not a single guy that I would pick him against. I mean, hell, we've seen him fight Costa and Whitaker. I think the one guy I would say, okay, the two fights that he could win, well, I think maybe Hermanson possibly, and then, like, Yo Romero. If we get a version of Yo Romero that craps his pants and just, like, stares at him, like he did against Adesanya. Like, if that's Yoel's strategy, like, going forward, then everyone's going to beat him because you're not going to win a fight not doing anything. But by and large, Jason, if, you know, all those fights headlined a show, and my prediction would be for his opponents to beat him, it would be a 5-0 sweep for that top 5. And I think for Uriah, I think that's where he is, man. He's just, when I watch him fight, he's pretty talented. He's got great power, for sure, man. And he's shown a growth and maturity, and he's put together a nice 3-fight win streak. But currently, in the landscape of the middleweight division, I think you have, you know, oh, I think the tiers are pretty simple. I think clearly Robert Whittaker is the next challenger for the title, even though, you know, he's not getting that opportunity quite yet. And I think you have that tier of contenders, that Costa to Romero tier. Maybe you would throw in Darren Till in that one as well. And then you have some guys on the outside looking in trying to break through. I think out of all the fighters with the biggest potential to break through, I think Derek Brunson would be the one I would point to that is most likely to break through. Uriah Hall certainly could too, but I think he's going to get a big-time fight. I think whoever he's scheduled to fight next, he will be, when you look at the betting odds, the underdog. So I think he certainly has the tools to be successful, the tools to go on this run and challenge for a championship. I think the absolute ceiling for Uriah Hall, when you look at his performance here and in some of his more recent performances, the absolute ceiling is to contend for a championship, to earn number one contendership status. That's when things are all going right, but I don't think we're going to see that. I think when he gets in those fights that determine the number one contender, I do think he's going to lose all of them.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. It's just, you know, there wasn't a ton I saw in that fight that made me think this is a guy that I would pick to beat someone in the top five. But look, he's going to get a remarkable fight in his next matchup. But I guess pretty much the big news coming out of UFC Vegas number 12 was the comments made by Bryce Mitchell following his win over Andre Fili. Great performance by Bryce Mitchell. I mean, look, I think that he's one of these guys that if you're a top 15 featherweight, you probably want to fight Bryce Mitchell now as opposed to later, because this guy is getting better. What he was able to do with his grappling and getting the fight to the ground. But I mean, there were some things you saw on the ground that kind of said, man, he shouldn't have lost that position there. I was listening to Kenny Florian, you know, talking about on his podcast, kind of a really interesting how to hear Kenny talk about from a grappling aspect of things that he saw things that Bryce Mitchell needs to work on. But really, the topic of Bryce Mitchell was after the fact in his post-fight press conference with the media there in Las Vegas, where he gave his opinions on mask and that he is, his views are what would be described as anti-mask. And I'm sure a lot of people have seen his quotes up there. And this is the quote that I want to mention, where he goes, quote, "There's going to be a lot of criticism and a lot of people attacking me for saying that, and they're going to say I'm a dumb MMA fighter and I got no sense sharing my opinion, but you know what? I pay my taxes, so you're going to tell me you can take the money out of my pocket, tens of thousands of dollars out of my pocket that I fought for, and you're going to take it out of my pocket and then discredit my opinions and say I don't have an opinion. No, I do have an opinion, and it does matter." Now, when I saw the video of this on Saturday, Daniel, one of my initial thoughts was that I believe a lot of MMA fighters will share the same exact opinion that Bryce Mitchell said, but they do not want to share it publicly because they do not want to obviously have the backlash that Bryce Mitchell has taken here. And I think, you know, and this is just my general thoughts on it. This is not like I haven't heard this from a fighter. I'm just saying this is just my general thought is I think the reason that a lot of fighters would likely believe that is if you're in a situation where you're in a state where they require you to wear a mask in the gym and you supplement your income by doing personal training sessions, you've probably lost a lot of clientele over the past couple of months.
Yeah, I totally understand their frustration. It's affected their lifestyle in a major way and their income in a major way. I mean, the mixed martial arts career is two-pronged in terms of its attachment to interaction with people, the fans in attendance and the people they train with, the customers in their gym. And those type of industries, along with the bars and strip clubs and stuff like that, have been most greatly affected by the pandemic. It's hard to work from home if you're running a mixed martial arts gym. It's quite difficult, and it's been a long time that we've been under this mandate and tough times. So I understand the frustration, and I understand everyone's entitled to their own opinion. You know, I strongly disagree with what Bryce said, but that's just my opinion. And my opinion is, you know, that masks are effective, and we're dealing with something that is a once in a lifetime pandemic. Right. And a lot of people have died. A lot of people have died. Like, and they had a lot of money in their pocket, but they weren't able to use it to get their life back. And I feel as though that, a lot of people have died because they got the virus and they got the virus because they got it from other people. And I feel strongly that wearing a mask where all the stuff that's coming out of your nose and your mouth, I think has a less chance of getting out there in public mm-hmm. spaces. And I think that's going to reduce the virus spreading. That's something that I believe in. And I believe that during this time, as we wait for a vaccine, I think it would have been great if everyone in our society believed in that as well. And we all wore masks. And I think a lot less people would have died. But that wasn't the case. It's a real divisive time. And a lot of people think that the government is overstepping their role. And I understand that opinion. And I respect them as humans and to have that opinion, right? Like, I think too often we try and villainize people for having different opinions. I think that opinion is a bit deadly because the net result is less people wearing masks and potentially more people getting the virus. And again, I just think it really comes down to perception of how much respect you give this virus. And I think some people aren't giving it the respect it deserves in terms of people dying, right? Like, it's something where, to me, when I look at the way this virus impacts people, I'm no expert, and I spent a lot less time thinking about the virus in the back end than the front end because I was exhausted. But, you know, I've known people who've gotten the virus and they've recovered. And I think what makes this virus so deadly is not that, you know, if you get it, it's a death sentence. It's just that so many people get it so easily that when you cast a wide net on all of these people with this virus, I think especially the people who have worse immune systems, you're going to have those results of deaths. That's why we have so many. So I just think the masks help out in a major way. And I think if we all bought into it, I think we would be in a much better society with a lot more people in it. But that's not the case. That's Bryce's opinion. I would just say that I disagree with it majorly. But I also think you bring up a good point, and that is the opinion of, I would assume, a significant portion of fighters.
Yeah, look, I'm not going to criticize Bryce Mitchell for what he said. I mean, look, he's offering his opinion. Do I agree with what he said? No, I do not. I do not agree. You know, I think it's, I guess my follow-up question with Bryce would be is, has anyone in your inner circle had COVID? And if they have not, would your thoughts be different? I get where he's coming from, but I think I view it comes from someone who has lost revenue because of it, and they're just angered by it. But I think that he said something that a lot of fighters likely believe, but they do not want the criticism that he's taking. So, I mean, look, as I said, I understand his frustration with everything, but look, we've got to put on a mask because we got to do our part to try to, eliminate this virus, because the fact is, we just don't know, if we go to the grocery store, if someone's going to walk around that has it, that just maybe has no clue that they have it. I mean, I was at the dentist yesterday, just getting a routine checkup. And I was like, there was a moment because like you go in and you got to fill out the forms for COVID. And one of the thoughts that I had was more along the lines of like, man, if you're a dentist, like, are you nervous about COVID?
I'm sure, man. I'm sure you are, bro. And I think dentists have done a great job of eliminating that possibility. But I guarantee you so many people are across the landscape, but especially dentists when you're getting up in people's chompers, right? You're getting up in there, but I guarantee you they've been thinking about, much like Universal that you mentioned earlier, they've been thinking about what they need to do to open their business back up and be as safe as possible and how they need to disinfect themselves. So I'm sure, man, I mean, that nerve is there. And I know it's a tough topic, right? We're so tired of talking about it, but I really hope this is a once in a lifetime deal, because I do think, sometimes in life, we have to adjust to whatever hand we're dealt. And I think we were dealt a really crappy hand this year in terms of the pandemic. And I don't think we made the best choices overall, but here we are. And I hope we get past this game of, high stakes poker. I hope we get a damn vaccine. I hope we don't deal with this anymore, because it's so tiring, it's so frustrating, there's so much anger involved, and it's something where I don't want to come on here and bash Bryce. I want to give him the respect he deserves while making the point that I vehemently disagree with that his statements.
I think it would be interesting. Like if you had a round table of like, you know, Bryce and, you know, maybe another athlete from another sport who, you know, shares the same feelings with Bryce and then have, you know, two people that are on the other side of the table. I'd be fascinated. I mean, look, I believe let's wear masks. Let's try to eliminate this. I mean, I'm 39 years old. I've never dealt with anything in my life like this, you know, and obviously my life has changed a lot. And I think we've all kind of learned how we can adapt our lives. I mean, look, being in, you know, I can tell you this, just knowing people in the radio industry, I'll tell you, I think the radio industry is going to change dramatically because of this. I think it's really taught the radio industry that a lot of this stuff can be done remotely. You know, I mean, look, I'm sitting here in my home office. I'm not in, you know, in my studio. I'm in my home office where I've created a studio, and I think we've all kind of learned to, you know, how we can adapt our lives. But in terms of one of the things I do want to talk about last week's UFC card, Alex Hernandez, he looked amazing. First fight under Mark Montoya at Factory X. He made a decision that he needed to, you know, and he mentioned to me last time I talked to him that, you know, the Drew Dober fight, he just felt lost. Like he just, you know, and knew he had to make changes. And man, he looked amazing on the preliminary card against Chris Grootsmacher, getting the TKO there in 1 minute and 46 seconds. As I think about like noble performances from the UFC card last weekend, Alex Hernandez sticks out to me.
Dude, that UFC card had a lot of them, like including Bryce Mitchell, by the way. His wrestling on point. And Andre Feely, really scrappy. Great win for that. Featherweight, but if we're going down the list of who impressed us the most, I think Alexander's right up there, man. I mean, Chris Grootsmacher is a tough opponent, and Hernandez was really dominant with his stand-up, bro. Like, just consistently great volume. And he started his career off with a lot of spotlight there, and he got the downturn. But it appears as though he's ready to garner some momentum and climb back up 155 rank. So I think he looked great against Grootsmacher, finishing him early in that fight, man. But it was a night of a lot of impressive performances. Like, you go to the main card and Greg Hardy. His jab to knock out Maurice Greene was dope. To knock someone out with a jab is quite an impeccable idea. And Greg Hardy executed that idea. And he got the win. I thought Kevin Holland, you know, taking down Ontiveros, and then Ontiveros verbally tapping out because of the slam, I guess. And then Holland getting up in Israel's face, being the first guy to go 4-0 this calendar year. He helped himself. And I thought the other three fights that were great were the knockouts. The Andre Yanez knockout over Victor Rodriguez. The Miles Johns knockout to start off the card where he hit Kevin Natividad. And the way Natividad hit the floor was crazy. He was like a fish, bro. He just, like, he had like a little spasm. That knockout was crazy. And Johns at bantamweight looked good, but the one guy I want to really mention too, along with Alexander Hernandez, would be Dustin Jacoby. I thought he looks like a real player at 205, and I know he was just taking on Justin Ledet, but Jacoby's stand-up looks top-notch, and I think this is a guy who can make a run towards some solid fights at 205.
Yeah, I mean, he's a guy that in Jacoby, I don't want to see him necessarily taking on, you know, grapplers, you know, just because of his fighting style. But yeah, it was, you know, overall a decent night there. Of course, you had Bellator on Thursday. Gegard Mousasi defeats Douglas Lima. Not the most exciting fight. It just seemed like Douglas Lima was just looking for that counter shot that just really, you know, never came in that fight. Performances, I'll know that. We mentioned about Henry Corrales. Great performance by him. The other one I'll mention, Sabah Hamasi with that flying knee knockout in the second round. He looked good in that matchup. And then Cody Law is definitely a guy to pay attention to, making his pro debut, gets submission win there in the first round. Great performance by him. And you know, really, to me, it, obviously with the Bellator card, it was all about that main event. And, you know, a fight that, you know, I think did not live up to my expectations.
Yeah, me neither. And I think for Bellator, unfortunately, it wasn't a success. Bellator 50 was not a success because Mousasi Lima was a great fight on paper, and it was a chance for a lot of people to watch their product. And if the fight was either entertaining or we had like a finish, there would be a lot more people paying attention to the result or the action that took place. But the fight itself was a fine five-round fight. It just didn't really register as much as you would have hoped if you're Bellator. So that's why it's a down night for Bellator. Technically, it was interesting. Rounds three and four were the most interesting rounds. Round four were pretty dang good. The stand-up was good. I just felt like Musasi was able to win this fight by out-grappling Lima when he needed to win the rounds that he needed. That's kind of Musasi's approach on the feet. It's not the most exciting. I think we got that with that 25-minute fight. So overall, we got the fight. Musasi's the champion. He's got the strap now again. And that's great for him. I think Lima's the more marketable of the two fighters. And I'm looking forward to seeing Musasi continue to compete. He's one of the best fighters on the planet. So is Lima. But overall, Bellator 250, I felt like, unfortunately, it was a thumbs down for Bellator just because they didn't have a memory, a moment people could attach to. Mm-hmm. Obviously, they lost the fight between Ortega and Desiree Yanez. Mm-hmm. So they put on Dalton Rosta, and he looked okay against Ty Guerter, winning that decision. But I thought the biggest story from Bellator, I thought the Jake Hager fight almost overshadowed the main event. I thought more people were talking about Hager and Brandon Colton than the main event. I mean, I thought that was, again, I just think that was a mistake. I have to put them on TV. And I think that showed when you look at where, you know, I would guarantee you that if you go to MMA Junkie, you know, the Jake Hager article probably got a lot more clicks than the Musasi Lima article post-fight. And I just thought that was a miscalculation from Bellator. But, you know, that fight was on YouTube, and it was okay. It was a fun little scrap, man. Hager got tested against Brandon Colton. He got pieced up in round two. Yeah, I mean, it was a fun little card, a lot of notable things. And I'm glad you brought up that Hamasi knockout, which if you haven't seen it, everyone, go check it out. A great flying EKO over Bobby Volker.
Yeah, man, it was just a great performance by him. Of course, Bellator is back tomorrow night with Bellator 251. A fight card that, I mean, look, I just, you know, we just gave you our straight feelings on this one. We don't hold back. It's a fight card to really get excited about. You know, we talked about the main event in previous weeks. It's just, it's a fight that just doesn't interest me of Melvin Manhoff versus Corey Anderson. I mean, Corey Anderson likely will just take Melvin Manhoff down and beat him up. You got Tyrell Fortune on the card. Probably the fight that interests me the most on the main card is Austin Vanderfort versus Vinicius De Jesus. Austin Vanderfort was supposed to fight Chris Curtis. Chris Curtis was fighting now. Vinicius De Jesus steps in here to take on Austin Vanderfort. You got, George Garhanian, obviously a name. He's on the preliminary card taking on Bryce Logan. Bryce Logan, one of those new, long-term signings that Bellator has made here. But overall, the Bellator card, it's tough to get excited about. I guess the one good thing is it's an early start time on Thursday. Prelims, 4:45 p.m. Eastern time. Main card, 7 p.m. Eastern time.
Yeah, man, even with the time there, I'm probably not going to be on my sofa right when the show starts. I'm probably going to have to DVR this one. This is one of those weeks where I'm going to have to skip through the commercials and watch this on my own time because this main card isn't demanding my attention. Jason, you know, Melvin Manhoff, man, I love that guy. He's an exciting fighter. He's competed in multiple sports, but it is 2020. He has won a few fights in a row, but he's also going up against Corey Anderson. And, I think his nickname is no longer Beastin 25-8, but that dude is always Beastin. And I think he's going to go out there and he's going to wrestle Melvin, even though Corey has displayed at times brutal knockout power. Overall, fight card, not super exciting. Fighters to look forward to watching fight like Vanderfort, Tyra, Fortune. But overall, I'm not too hyped about Bellator 251. For me personally, I'm more so looking forward to the fight card the following week. I think all three of those fights are kind of exciting. It's not the strongest effort by Bellator, for sure. And I don't think people will be talking about Bellator 251, unfortunately. in the post-match. But whatever happens, you know, you can tune into us and we will tell you what we thought of it. And we will talk about it next week.
Of course, also coming here tonight on Wednesday night, you got the return of Dana White's Contender Series on ESPN Plus as they'll finish up this year. And of course, they announced the return of the Ultimate Fighter. Which, you know, Daniel, I was thinking about it because now, of course, you know, obviously the question comes, who's coming as coaches? I, you know what, and look, I haven't watched really, truly watched The Ultimate Fighter since the ATT Black Zillion season. It's just a show, you know, I would give me Contender Series as opposed to Tough. I just, that's my opinion. But, like, to me, I know this will not happen, Daniel. I would love it if they would do retired fighters as coaches as opposed to active fighters.
Who would be, by the way, the one moment for The Ultimate Fighter to succeed would have been the pandemic when it first started. Like, they should have had a season of the Tough in the can whenever we had nothing to watch. And if they had unleashed at that time, that would have been the only thing that would have revived The Ultimate Fighter. Without looking, Jason, two things before I address your question, or just one thing. What season of The Ultimate Fighter do you think this is? Unless you already know because you've seen the headlines. What season is it?
I just want you to... It's 29?
Yeah. Freaking 29 seasons! What the hell? I'm pretty sure that show, As the World Turns, hasn't had that many seasons. Oh my god, one of these days, I'm just going to ask you to name all the coaches for all the seasons of The Ultimate Fighter. I want you to go in order. I like the idea of retired fighters. The question is, it's a simple question. If you're producing The Ultimate Fighter, your goal is to get people to watch your show. Which retired fighters do you think would get people to watch? What is the best case scenario for the UFC? If you're the UFC and you're looking to put on a marketable show, Jason, you got a big time checkbook and you're willing to write out a check for anyone, which two coaches are you putting on that show to get this show back on track and get more people paying attention and interacting with it?
Well, if you get Conor McGregor on, that'll get people interacting with it. But like, if I was looking at retired fighters, I don't know who you put up against them as the other coach. How about you start with Michael Bisping? Because you know Michael Bisping would stir the pot.
Yeah, he would be great. I think he's – that's a good one. I mean, maybe Bisping versus Daniel Cormier if they're both retired. Because, like, I think they both know how to perform. The thing is, I think the reason why the retired coaches wouldn't work is because I think one of the biggest sells of The Ultimate Fighter was the hate between the coaches. I really feel like that formula really worked. And you get the payoff with the fight. In terms of the retired guys, like, I would think, me, you know, if you're looking for pure entertainment, a Matt Serra type would be a great idea. You know, on one side you have Matt Serra, on the other side you have Joe Rogan.
No. You know who needs to be up against Matt Serra?
Oh, yes. Diego Sanchez's coach.
Joshua Fabia. Oh, my God. Yeah. Could you? Okay, look. If you told me Joshua Fabia was the head coach of one team, that might get me to tune in.
I think we just saved The Ultimate Fighter. If we have Josh Fabia versus Matt Serra, I think we have... Like we might have killed two fighters because Joshua Fabia's training methods might be too dangerous. He's going out there running at knives on people. He's gonna have a training session where he's like, okay, I have an AK-47. If you can dodge a bullet, you can dodge a punch. Like, he's like that guy is insane. I think we save The Ultimate Fighter. Sign me up. Josh Fabia versus Matt Serra. I'm all in on this one. I mean, Josh Fabia versus Michael Bisping. I think Michael Bisping would tear that guy a new asshole, and I think that'd be great too.
Yeah, just give us Josh Fabia. Come on, yeah. UFC. Do it for us. Yeah.
Can you imagine being on Josh Fabia's team if you're a fighter? Oh, you're God. Like, gosh darn it.
Could you imagine that team selection? The guys are like, are sitting there going, please don't pick me. Please don't pick me. I know. Please don't pick me.
Yeah, they'd pick him, and Josh would pick him, and the guy would just be like, no, I'm staying here. I'm not going on your team, you crazy dude.
Yeah, I mean, I want to say it's going to debut in March. I want to say they start filming in, I want to say January. So we'll see how that one goes. But yeah, it's, but of course, you know, we got also UFC coming up on Saturday night, Thiago Santos versus Glover Teixeira. You know, before Dana White's announced that Israel Adesanya is going to be, you know, challenge Jan Blachowicz for a 205-pound title, I was kind of thinking this fight was going to be a number one contender's fight on this matchup. And you know, we were talking before the show about, you know, some of the fights on the undercard that stick out to us. You know, I mentioned Brandon Allen versus Ian Heinisch. I know there's a little heat between those two guys. That's a really good matchup at 185 pounds. And you mentioned about the women's 115-pound fight of Claudia Gadelha and Yan Jinan. That's a good one there. You know, sticks. Those are probably the two fights that I think we really got to stick out of, you know, outside that main event of what's bringing you to the television set on Saturday night.
Yeah, this is another one of those fight night cards. It doesn't get you super energized to be there. There aren't a lot of big time matchups. I mean, Tanner Boser has an opportunity to use Andrei Arlovski as a stepping stone to fortify his heavyweight rank. But those are the three fights. I mean, also that bantamweight matchup between Ronnie Barcelos and Kyla Taha is fine. Okay. Like, let's watch that one. Okay, that'll be good. But Claudia Gadelha, Yan Jinan, that's my number two fight. I just think that's a really relevant women's strawweight fight, and I think the world is on, and I think Gadelha has proven that she's a consistent stalwart. Heinisch Allen, you're right, a great 185 matchup. But the overall draw for me is the main event. It's not the sexiest matchup on, like, Glover and Santos aren't two big-time names, but they're so relevant to 205, and realistically, the winner of this fight does deserve a title fight. And I kind of wish that's where we were at. But maybe the UFC thinks, man, maybe the UFC thinks the most marketable champion at 205 is Adesanya, which that is a valid point. It's just he'll have two straps, but maybe that's why they're booking that fight. But I feel bad for Santos. But it's an unbelievable story for him. You know, he fought John Jones. He practically beat him. And he tore more ligaments in his leg than I knew the human body even had. And it's impressive that he is here today and he's going to compete. It's a tough road to come back and you're taking on Glover Teixeira. And Glover, man, he has gone on a run, especially with that Anthony Smith victory. He is looking for business. And you mentioned to me how you were a bit surprised about how big of a favorite Santos is. I think on Best Fight Odds, you look and Santos is minus 240. And I get what you're putting down because he's going up against a real killer and a guy who's – it's kind of like his last ride. He's still in his prime and he's performing well, but he is up there in age and Glover. And that's just a tough ask coming off the type of rehabilitation and injuries that Santos is.
Yeah, I mean, when you talk about what he, you know, obviously that TKO win that Glover had back in March, May, against Anthony Smith, this is a guy that, look, he's at the tail end of his career, but I think the fight booking of Adesanya Blachowicz, I think just really tells you what the UFC is trying to set up.
Yeah, John Jones and Adesanya. And you know what? I can't blame them because that's the big money matchup. That's one of those fights you put on and the whole world pays attention. And that's the model of the UFC. The whole world pays attention. That's what they're building towards. That's when the bank account gets a little bit thicker. So I get it, 100%. But, you know, a great opportunity for Jan for Jan Blachowicz, the biggest fight for him is John Jones. And the second biggest fight is Adesanya. And then you have the light heavyweight contenders. I think the winner of this fight deserves the title fight. I don't think they need to fight Dom Reyes, and that's the only guy that might be above them in the rankings after this one, even though Santos is already above Reyes. So, look, I think the winner of this fight doesn't need to fight anymore. They need to wait out until their next fight's for the championship.
It's hard to do, man. You know, it's hard to do, yeah. Especially, you know, when the UFC throws that paycheck at you. It's kind of, you know. I mean, like, you know this, man, the show will always go on with the UFC. You know, it's always going to go on. They're always going to put, you know, someone, you know, next up. But, you know, to me, look, it's very clear. They want to do Adesanya Jones. And, you know, that's a fight that if it ever does come together in 2021, it's one of those fights that you're like, man, hopefully you love for that fight to happen in front of fans, just have that kind of that energy of a crowd, because it definitely, you know, it's, I mean, I think MMA is one of those sports where I think that you can still kind of, you know, you can do it without fans where it doesn't lose a lot. But man, when you have, you know, there is something about a big fight feel and having fans in attendance.
Yeah, yeah, it is, man. I mean, MMA more so than other sports, I think, has handled the lack of fans better than most. I mean, I think football has done an impeccable job, you know, with their games. But for mixed martial arts, when you go back and you rewatch some of the great fights in history, the fans play such a major role, and they really make fights that much more entertaining. They really do. The ebb and flow of the audio of the crowd to go along with an absolute banger of a fight makes it that much more legendary. And also the mystique of the entrance is lost without the fans. It really is. And those moments are also incredibly special. And to lose that sucks, but Jones versus Audit, like, there's just something about that walkout, bro. That intensity. It's the biggest fight of the year. You know, the people in attendance save their paycheck and they put on their best looking tap out shirt and they got their butt to the arena. And this is the big time. I mean, there's something about that type of intensity that gets you freaking excited. I cannot wait for that to happen again. I think the timing is right for that Jones Adesanya fight. You know, God willing, we get this thing under control by that point in time. I think from a time frame standpoint, the timing is right. And I just cannot wait for a full crowd of people watching a super fight. I'm hyped.
Yeah, I just question really is going to be is when will that happen? Something to note before we get out of here. You know, obviously there was we mentioned about Mike Mazzulli earlier in the show, and of course he had a moment last week at the weigh-ins, and just saw this on Twitter. Nolan King, of course, a great MMA reporter, works for MMA Junkie, who's on the scene in the Mohegan Sun. And he tweeted, he goes, "It's already out there. He's apologized, meaning Mazzulli. But for what it's worth, before today's weigh-ins, Mohegan Sun Commission head Mike Mazzulli reiterated to everyone in the room that he was in the wrong during last week's Brandon Gertz incident." So I think that's something you know, to note, because, you know, obviously there was, you know, when situations happen like that, I mean, we don't always necessarily hear from commission people. So obviously Mike Mazzulli was in the wrong there. No question about it there. And that became a little bit of a viral moment there last week, but you know, he did apologize to Brandon Gertz. So something just to kind of mention here before we get out of here. Daniel, is there anything else you want to touch on before we get out of here for this edition of the podcast?
You know, nothing, man, other than I hope everyone out there feels like they have a good day and a good week. And again, I know it's a stressful time, but you know, it's nice to get our minds off the world for a little bit, talk some mixed martial arts. But when you get back and you interact with the world, everyone, go out there and love your coworkers, love your friends, your family, and you know, try to make the world a better place. You know, let's have a good time with it. We know our moral values, our ethics, and let's get after it. But, you know, regardless of what happens, you know, there's a lot of people in this country who think differently. And I think personally, if we kind of unify and really listen to each other, I think we'll be in a better place. But peace, love, and prosperity, Jason. That's what I'm preaching during these tough, anxiety-ridden times.
Also, one other thing I do want to mention. I do want to apologize. Didn't get a podcast out on Sunday, an interview edition of the podcast.
Why didn't you, Jason? You got a damn Buccaneers game on Monday, and you didn't get the podcast out, Jason. What the heck?
It was a family day for me, so I took Sunday off, but we will have a podcast on Sunday. One of the interviews that will be on there, Kurt Hollebaugh. I'm actually going to be producing up that video today. Also, interesting conversation with Regional Fighter Chandler Cole, who is at one time, he mentioned about how he was weighing 300 pounds. He's currently a heavyweight. He is working his way down to 205 pounds. Had an interesting conversation with him. Also, let you know, I'm going to be doing a couple of interviews today. I'm going to be talking to Justin Jacoby, among others. Also talking to Adrian Yanez. So those will be on the podcast as well. Going to get that to you on Sunday, as Sunday night football here in Tampa, as the Bucs be playing the Saints on Sunday night. So this is... it's man, we've got a couple of big primetime games up here in the next couple of weeks. So, but yeah, just wanted to mention that as kind of basically just took the day off on Sunday to spend time with the family. So I do want to apologize for that, but I will have a podcast on Sunday. Of course, Daniel joins me every Wednesday. We talk about the latest going on in the world of mixed martial arts. Of course, you can get this podcast at radioinfluence.com, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, TuneIn, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, wherever you get your podcast. You can get the MMA Report podcast there. While you're there, be sure to give us a 5-star rating and review. That does help out the podcast a lot. So that is going to do it for this edition of the MMA Report podcast, which is available every week on radioinfluence.com.
This is A Place for My Head Quick Picks on Radio Influence.
Very excited, very happy to have a guest like this today. Please, everybody, welcome Jason Redman.
So we are 1 week from going home from deployment in September of 2007. And we launched on a mission to go after a senior Al-Qaeda leader. And to make a long story short, my team and I walked into a very well-executed ambush. And multiple members of my team and myself included were all shot up. I was shot 8 times between the body armor and body. I took 2 rounds in the left elbow, which pretty much almost took my arm off. They talked about amputating in the hospital. And I took a round in the face.
Oh, my God.
Needless to say, a lot of damage. So fast forward 96 hours later, I find myself laying in a hospital bed in Bethesda, Maryland. And I don't want to say it was the same as that the end moment I felt when I was ready to take my life in Afghanistan. It was a different the end moment, but I felt the same. And I felt like I was laying in that hospital bed, having doctors and nurses just overwhelm me with information like, hey, Lieutenant Redman, you know, you've been all shot up and you're trached, you're wired shut. We're feeding you through a stomach tube. You have no use of your left hand. You've suffered massive nerve damage. You took 2 rounds in the left elbow. Your elbow is totally destroyed. We're thinking about amputating your arm. You obviously have massive damage to your face. It's going to take years to put you back together. And they were telling me all this. I'm like, man, what the hell? You know, I just climbed out of this deep, dark, black hole. And now you're telling me I'm back in another one?
A Place for My Head with Brandon Thompson and Jerry Petuck can be found on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Google Podcasts, and RadioInfluence.com.